Today we're bringing to our audience the story of a remarkable artist whose prowess and courage may be unknown to many of this generation. The subject is famed cellist Gregor Piatigorsky. Our guests are Margaret Bartley, who's written a fascinating book on his early life, and Jeffrey Solow, a teacher here at Temple, who was also a former student of the maestro. Welcome to Crossover. We're delighted to have you here.
I think I'm a little overwhelmed with the subject matter because I feel quite excited that we have finally gotten hold of you and brought you down here to talk about one of the greatest artists of the 20th century, Gregor Piatigorsky, cellist. And Margaret, tell us a little bit about how you got involved with this subject.
Well, first of all, I have to explain, I am a historian. I am not a musician. And to tackle a subject like Gregor Piatigorsky, one of the great musical artists of the time, was a bit daunting for me. I actually got into the subject because I live in the Adirondack Park, and when I moved there, I found out that Gregor Piatigorsky's home was across the street from where I lived, and that my husband had been a playmate of his children. So my husband grew up with the Piatigorsky family and told me lots of stories about him. But it wasn't until I met the Piatigorsky children, Joram and Jephtha, that I really got to know the subject. And that was because I was given a gift of Gregor Piatigorsky's biography, Cellist, published in 1965, and his wife's biography, published in 1985, called Jump in the Waves. And when I read those two books, I was so amazed by this man's life that I went back to his daughter and said, I'd like to write a magazine article about your father's time in New York, in the Adirondacks. The Piatigorsky family lived there from 1939 to 1949. And this was sort of an area of his life that was kind of unknown. Most people knew him from University of Southern California and his collaborations with Yasha Heifetz. So I was kind of going into an area that had not been well explored. And I did write a magazine piece for Adirondack Life magazine, but it was only 4 pages long. And I went back to his daughter and said, this is not enough. Your father's story is too large, too rich, and I would like to write his biography. And she said, go for it, and opened up the family library, the family photo albums to me. And they have been great supporters of this project.
Well, what I want to say, too, is the book that you have written, which is entitled Grisha, which was the name, I guess, was that a diminutive of Gregor? His mother called him that, too.
It's exactly the same as Yasha Heifetz. His name was Joseph, but Yasha is the diminutive.
Okay. Well, the reason that I am so overwhelmed with the book is that it's written as it would be Piatigorsky, of course, telling the story of what was going on, although it is a narrative, and to get into his most private soul there, and the way you have done that is really quite amazing.
Well, but when I realized I was going to tackle this pretty large project, I went and read many, many musical biographies, a number of them by Heifetz, Arthur Rubinstein, Nathan Milstein, and they all, they were fascinating, but they tend to start the same way. They tend to start with Gregor Piatigorsky was born on April 17th, 1903, in the city of Ekaterinoslav, Ukraine. And I thought that's really not going to grab an audience attention. It might for a music scholar. I really wanted to reintroduce Gregor Piatigorsky to a public that had largely forgotten him. So I decided to present his life story through his eyes so that the reader takes a journey with him. They're along with him as he discovers music, as he evolves as an artist. And one of the comments his daughter said to me was, "My father was always on the run. People were always trying to kill him. He was running from the Tsarist pogroms. He ran from the Russian Revolution. He ran from the Nazis. He didn't stop running until he came here. And here wasn't just the United States. It was this tiny little town in the Adirondacks of northern New York where he finally became a citizen in 1942.
It's really quite amazing. Of course, Jeffrey picks it up much later because he studied with him. Where did you study with him?
I studied with him in Los Angeles. I was going to UCLA, but Piatigorsky taught at USC, So it was interesting to be enrolled in the two crosstown rival schools.
and again, you, as I say, we pick up his life and his personality from the time that that you studied mm-hmm. with him, which of course is when he was already established. And I must say that I had a little brush with him when I was a student at Tanglewood. I met him after a concert one night with some other musicians, and he was just amazing. But the funniest part was he was carrying this huge salami, and evidently he loved salami. And I think, Margaret, you said something about it, or was it Jeffrey? You had said that he loved salami?
I came across a reference where he wrote about one of his early years in Berlin where he was starving. He spent a lot of time starving, was reduced at one point to eating cat food when somebody fed their pet, and he basically showed up at the door of one of his music friends and kind of crashed for the night, and the friend said, "You look terrible. Have you eaten?" And he said, "Not in several days," and the friend gave him salami. And he devoured the entire thing and said it was the best food he had ever eaten in his life.
Well, he evidently loved it, and he brought this salami. I think it was about 4 feet long. I have never seen anything so big in my life, with his vodka. And, of course, he, as I said, regaled us with wonderful tales. He was an imposing, very handsome man, very tall, and I don't want to offend any, very Russian his whole personality was. And, of course, Jeff, you know him so well as a student. How was he as a teacher?
The thing that he was most concerned with his students was that they communicate. And that's the thing, of course, that he was most concerned with as an artist. He was very much as a person, a people person. And so when as a performer, his main goal was to communicate to the audience. And he looked at the cello, even though, of course, he loved the cello and was a great cellist. But the cellist was a means to another end. And that other end was communication. It was not an end in itself. And that was his number one goal for his students, that he would say, for instance, in regard to technique, he would point out that lots of people had the idea that technique was just mechanism, that when someone says someone has a good technique, they just mean the physical mechanism of particularly their left hand moving quickly. But he's, of course, not alone in defining technique in the way that yes. I'm about to say. But his definition of technique was all of the means at your disposal to communicate your ideas.
So, well, in other words, it's the vehicle for which you can communicate.
Right.
And so
in his teaching, what he would say is, first you have to have an idea. And when you have an idea, then you develop the technical means to put that idea across. This, of course, is a style of teaching that works best when you have very talented students. If you have yes. students who have real instrumental impediments, I should say, it doesn't work necessarily quite so well.
Very, very tactfully put. What I couldn't get over, Margaret, was I read part, the beginning of the book, several of the chapters, that he was told as a child that he had no talent.
Yes, there was. His father took him there was a traveling group that came through town, and his father took him there, and the man was very uninterested and kind of listened and said, "You have no talent."
Yeah, he shouldn't be playing this, or he should try the violin or something.
And he said at first he was a little kid. He went home and parked the cello in the corner and went out and played soccer in the street. But he kept being drawn back to it. And finally his father said, "All right, I can see you want to play it. Go ahead." And at that point he just took off.
He started himself, though. I mean, he really didn't learn from anybody initially.
His father was a violin and viola player and said, "Hey, they're all in the string family. I can teach you." But he said that didn't really work very well. He actually, before he ever got an instrument, took two sticks and tried to pretend it was a cello
yes.
because he had seen it in a concert.
Yeah, he was taken with that. Of course, we are talking about facts, but when you read the book, I just can't get it across. It is so... it is so real. You are in that person. You the way you have written it, you're in the brain of this child, and you feel this emotional, the whole reaction to the music and to the cello and what it means to him. It becomes an entity to him ultimately, I think, as he gets older.
I think it's important to point out, you describe it as a dramatic narrative. Is that mm-hmm. your term? That it's not, this Grisha is not a biography per se, and
not as traditional biography.
I mean, as you said, that you didn't want to start, Grigor Piatigorsky was born mm-hmm. in Ekaterinoslav, and so it reads like a novel, but it's firmly grounded in the truth of his life. But of course, the psychological things about what he's thinking, although a lot of that stuff gets transmitted through oral tradition because he was such a great storyteller. Actually, when I started reading the book, the first two pages after the title page stuck together.
Oh, no.
And so I went from the title page right into the first page, and I never saw your little author's note. And so it was actually kind of a surprise to me when I launched into the book and realized, oh, this is a lot different than I had thought.
Well, I couldn't put it down, I must tell you, and I have a lot of things to read, and I just sat there kind of reading this thing. Like, it's a quick read, I think. But the description, of course, of his early experiences with the pogroms, as you say, and then of course the communists, and then I guess he ran the whole gamut of fear and fleeing, and fear and flight, I guess it is.
It took 5 years of research to write the book. I started it in 1999, and it was finally released the end of 2004. And fortunately, because of the internet and because of the fall of the Iron Curtain, I was able to correspond with the Moscow Conservatory, the Berlin Philharmonic Archives. And when it came time to describe the place he had been born, the city of Ekaterinoslav in Ukraine, now, because of eBay, there are people in Eastern Europe selling antique photo postcards of the city.
Oh, my.
So that when I describe the train station as having a green tile roof with two towers, I have a photograph of it.
My goodness.
That they had cobblestone streets with trolley cars. I found the music shop, a photo of the music shop in the Jewish shopping district, so that I was able to actually recreate what it looked like.
That's so incredible. It's so incredible. I must say, without pictures, you certainly create that when you read it. It's a very, very picturesque and very well written, and of course just grabs you right away. And I am quite thrilled with the book, as
one
you can
of the things
tell.
That I found really fascinating about reading Grisha is that I did know him pretty well and spent a lot of time with him because we lived close to each other. So aside from being his student and then later his teaching assistant, I would spend a lot of time at his house with his family and with his wife, Jacqueline, who I still see whenever I go out to California. But for his early life, mostly I knew about it from reading his autobiography, Cellist, which you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. and a little bit from reading Jacqueline's memoir, kind of oddly entitled Jump in the Waves, when she really originally wanted to call it Rothschild But a Girl. That was her original title, which I think was a better one.
Much better title.
A lot of things that Piatigorsky in Cellist kind of covers in a paragraph or maybe a page for some things. Once you actually read about them in a more extended way, it makes you really realize what an amazing life he had and person he was, because he was really a self-created personality.
Yes.
I mean, obviously he was born with remarkable genetic endowment, I don't mean just musically, but physically and personality-wise, because he developed an incredible sense of self at a very young age.
We just heard the third movement of the Cello Sonata No. 2 in C Major by Luigi Boccherini. This was a recording that was made in 1941 with cellist Gregor Piatigorsky, Valentin Pavlovsky at the piano.
And he grew up physically very early because he was 6'3½". And he was very tall at a very young age. But one of the things that Maggie talks about in her book is when he and his father and his brother were contracted for a musical tour, and he was, I believe, 11 at the time. Mm-hmm. And they went out on this tour from city to city, and then they got stiffed by the contractor at the end, and they were left with no money, so they had to sit in the city in which they were, play, earning money as musicians, playing what they could play. And then his father and his brother, I guess his father kind of realizing that Piatigorsky was so self-possessed, but 11 years old, he left him in the city by himself while the two of the other two, the father and the brother, took the train home and said, okay, earn enough money till you get your train fare and then come home.
And it was, they only had enough fare for two tickets, not three. The distance from where he was left to back to Moscow was over 1,000 miles. And he was left on his own to earn enough money to make his way back. And he didn't quite get enough.
So he played the part of essentially a depression hobo in the United States. And he walked and rode the rails and hitchhiked all the way home.
Well,
11 years old.
It's really, the story in itself is amazing, but again, the way it's told, you really are in it with him. And I think that's the thing that is so different about this book.
I wanted the reader to take a journey with him.
And you do. You take a journey with him.
It is in by no means a comprehensive biography because I stopped when he becomes an American citizen in 1942, when he finally stops running. Of course, he had another half of his life left, which Jeff is much more knowledgeable about than I am. But if I had continued on till his death, the book would have been the size of, you know, the New York Metropolitan Phone Book.
How did he get to upstate New York? I mean, he came to this country.
Yeah, it's a really ironic kind of funny story. Things were going very badly in Europe in the 30s. He had been part of the Berlin Philharmonic. He had an apartment in Berlin when he started on his solo career. In fact, he arrived on his first U.S. tour in New York City in 1929 on the day the stock market crashed. Of course, he didn't understand that and walked right into the Great Depression. But he finally, in 1932, had to leave Berlin when the Nazis took over and settled in Paris. And then when the 1939, when the war began, he had to leave Paris because being Jewish and being a celebrity, he was a target. What happened was a few months before the war began, in the winter and spring of 1939, he was on his annual U.S. tour, and he met a couple of friends who said, you know, it'd be really smart if you owned property in the United States, because if things go bad, you need someplace to go. And he said, yeah, you know, a little bungalow, a cottage someplace would be nice. And a friend, a sponsor of music patron, invited him up to visit the Adirondacks in northern New York. And he was in New York City at the time. So he came up alone. He left his wife and infant daughter at the hotel so he didn't drag them around. And he was hooked up with a real estate agent and said, yeah, I'm looking for a little bungalow. I'm only going to spend $5,000, tops. And the guy says, I've got just the place for you, and took him to a basically an abandoned summer home called Windy Cliff. It looks like an English Tudor castle built on a mountainside. And Windy Cliff had been abandoned. The person who had owned it had, during the Depression, stopped paying the taxes. And so the real estate agent took him up and showed him the place. And he says, look, I told you I wanted a cottage, $5,000. I'm not spending any more than that. And he was very angry with the real estate agent and went back to New York to take the boat back to Paris. And he got a telegram that summer saying, your $5,000 offer was accepted for Windy Cliff. It covered the back taxes. And a few weeks later, the war began, and they escaped. He and his wife and daughter escaped on one of the last boats out of France on September 2nd, came to New York with a suitcase and a cello. And went, what are we going to do now? Oh, we own Windy Cliff. They moved into the summer camp in mid-September when everybody's closing up the camps because they're not heated. And that's where he comes into play with my husband's family and became a resident of the Adirondacks. The really ironic thing is Windy Cliff, which was built in 1896, is located in what they call a hamlet, a tiny little settlement called New Russia.
Yes.
And people say, oh, is it named that because he came there? And I said, well, no, the name is much older than that, but he is the first Russian that we know of that ever lived in New Russia.
Well, maybe it's because it's so cold up there, right?
He fell in love with the Adirondacks because it reminded him of Russia, the white birches, the snow, the green, the hillsides, and he loved it there.
So once again, he lived there for 10 years, you said?
Yeah, that was his home. And what happened was he lived there. The Windy Cliff, the big summer home, you can't live in it in the winter. It's too cold. But there was a caretaker's cottage, and they basically lived in that in the winter until 1942, when Emanuel Feuerman, the cellist at Curtis, died suddenly and unexpectedly, and Ephraim Zimbalist offered Piatigorsky the position as cello teacher at Curtis. So in the winter after 1942, he began living here in Philadelphia at Rittenhouse Square, but considered, he just had an apartment, but they considered New Russia their real home. It was really the first time he had had a home of his own. I think he felt very safe and secure there.
So he was in Philadelphia for how long?
Till 1949. He taught at Curtis
about
from 42 to 49. And then moved to Los Angeles.
Which was a lot warmer.
Well, you know, of course, in Los Angeles, there was a burgeoning artist colony. You know, Heifetz lived there, and Stravinsky, and Arthur Rubinstein, Tomas Mann. But, you know, it's interesting, Jill, that you mentioned that one thinks of Piatigorsky more associated with California because he lived there for so long. But a lot of people don't realize what an impact that he had on the East Coast. Just now, Maggie was mentioning that he taught at Curtis, which a lot of people
don't realize. I don't think a lot of people are even aware of that.
But there's another ongoing impact that he had on the East Coast, which is connected with his living in Windy Cliff. I mean, I always actually knew about his living in Elizabethtown. I mean, that's what I'd heard, but I didn't. And that's the largest community right near there. And I didn't really know the name Windy Cliff until I read this book and or knew Russia. But one of the things that I found out from getting to know Maggie and this area was that when he lived there, he would, being a very gregarious social person, he would invite his friends up from New York and Philadelphia, many of whom were musicians and Russian musicians. And one of the people that he brought up there was the famous violin teacher, Ivan Galamian.
Oh, yes, from Juilliard.
And so Piatigorsky is actually the cause of Galamian founding Meadowmount.
Which is
still going strong.
Any aspiring young violinist would go there at summer camp.
And he was their first cello teacher at Meadowmount.
Mm-hmm.
And
now also the proceeds of the book are...
Yes, a portion of the money from the sale of this book I asked to have it given to Meadowmount to create a Piatigorsky cello scholarship, which it is doing. So, of course, we love selling books so that we can keep this scholarship going for a cello student.
How do you feel about all this? I mean, what impact did this have on you?
Writing this book really kind of took my life in another direction because I had spent 26 years teaching high school history. That's been my life's career. And one of the things about the book is I think I kept thinking of my own students and what would appeal to them. And already this book is being used in some high schools as part of their curriculum because I worked with a teacher to create a teacher study guide so that the book can be used to teach history, music, and biography.
How wonderful.
And but what happened was once I started writing the book, I realized I needed to learn more. And so I retired from teaching and went to Johns Hopkins University and got my master's of creative writing. This was my thesis. And then about 2 years into the project, I realized I had to learn to play the cello.
Oh, my.
And I had played the French horn in the marching band in high school. That was the last time I had... had any close encounters with music. So I found a really bad, cheap Chinese cello and tried to teach myself from a book for 2 years and then finally realized that wasn't working and went out to the Meadowmount School, which is, you know, I know some of the people there, and I've been taking lessons from one of the older students. I'm not quite ready for the big guys yet.
I know that it's very advanced.
Yeah, they're not going to accept me as a regular student. But last summer, I had a chance to study with Jeffrey at Lake Placid.
Now, is that how you met?
I actually had met him when I interviewed him. He was one of the first people I interviewed when I wrote the book. And we just corresponded by email, I think, at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I certainly knew of him. I tried to contact every living student that Piatigorsky ever had.
So then we had another interesting connection because another person that Maggie had gotten to know was Elsa Hilger, who was the first woman in the Philadelphia Orchestra and used to teach cello at Temple University. And I'm on the board of directors of ASTA, the American String Teachers yes. Association. And I guess it was last year we gave Elsa our Lifetime Achievement Award. And I was going to go up and present it to her in person at age 101.
My goodness.
And she died 2 weeks before I went up there. So the concert that I was going to play honoring her turned into a memorial concert, but her family came. And and actually, Maggie, being very practical about such things, I had said that I wanted to get a signed photo of Elsa. And so and I knew that I had gotten several pictures of her, and Maggie said, well, I'll just go over the next time I see her and have her sign it, because when you're 100, you never know.
Yeah, and I guess it was just a few weeks before
right.
she passed
oh,
away.
My.
But I actually had a chance to take a couple lessons with Elsa. So I like to say I've studied with Jeffrey, I've studied with Elsa Hilgar, studied with the greats. I'm not a very good cellist, but I'm having a wonderful
but
time.
But isn't that wonderful? It's difficult. It's a difficult instrument.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. I also, just before I went up there, or actually it was right before the ASTA conference where I presented her award in absentia, I was going through a box of LPs that was going to be deacquiesced by Temple because it was things that a lot of them had been damaged in a leak. And as I was going through these records, I found a recording from 1970 of Elsa Hilgar playing the Rococo Variations with the Temple University Symphony Orchestra.
My.
So I made a cassette and sent it up there, and she heard it.
And they played it for her,
and they played it at the memorial, but she was delighted to hear it. So mm-hmm. that was kind of a real serendipitous thing.
It's really quite unbelievable, though, that all of this. Of course, it's a journey back into the past and into a wonderful world of music. I mean, of course, again, the background of Piatigorsky and the way he and what he did, as you say, as he was always running, but finally, when he did, of course, achieve such enormous fame, again, so many people that are younger today really are not aware. I'm sure, Jeffrey, your students, not your students particularly, but you have come across students that didn't really know that much.
Absolutely,
about
Piatigorsky. They know virtually nothing. I mean, they may not even know his name because students, of course, when they buy recordings of the currently popular artists.
Yes.
Although I must say that CDs, for those that are interested to ferret such things out,
yes.
have made old historical recordings incredibly accessible.